This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In mid-February, President Bush called on the Iraqi military and the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands and force Saddam Hussein to step aside. First Shiites in the south, then Kurds in the north, began to fight the Iraqi military. But the president says it is not our place to intervene or to protect them against Saddam Hussein's brutal suppression of their rebellion. But today the president authorized an airdrop of $10 million worth of food, blankets, and clothing for Kurdish refugees. Millions of Kurds are fleeing the Iraqi army. Many are trapped at the borders with no place to go. What is our responsibility to the Iraqi people? Earlier today, we put this question to two Middle East experts, Professor Fred Halliday and journalist Patrick Tyler. First, we'll hear from Tyler, a reporter for The New York Times. He reported from Baghdad for the 6 weeks preceding the war. Since then, he's been filing from Washington. I asked him if he's heard any difference between the Bush administration's official and unofficial reasons for staying out of the conflict.
I think unofficially what you hear in slightly sharper tones, Terry, is a very strong reluctance on the part of the Bush administration to get involved in something that there may be no way out of. Getting involved militarily to protect the Kurdish rebellion or the Shiite rebellion in southern Iraq contemplates a significant military involvement by the United States at a time when it has no United Nations mandate to go farther, at a time when it is politically apprehensive about the potential of Iraq splitting apart, and it is somewhat reticent about all of the motives of those who are pushing the most strongly for the United States to take sides in this internal conflict.
Although President Bush urged the Iraqis to overthrow Saddam Hussein, some people are saying what he really wanted was a military coup, not a popular uprising. What the United States wanted was stability, not necessarily democracy. What do you think?
Well, on that point, Terry, that is where many people are questioning the wisdom of the president's tactics in the wake of the military defeat. If the administration wanted to change the government in Baghdad, one has to ask the question, well, how did it intend for that to happen? And therefore, what did the administration do in order to encourage that objective to be met? One thing we saw that it did in public was that it exhorted people to rise up. It's the people of Iraq to change the government, to convince Saddam Hussein to leave. The president also sent some very specific warnings to Baghdad that it better not use chemical weapons against the insurgents who were in the early stages of their rebellion. And then, he kept a very hard proscription against the Iraqi military using any kind of fixed-wing aircraft and toyed with the idea of extending that ban to helicopter gunships in order to protect the insurrection. If that was all part of a strategy to help changed the government, the administration then very quickly came to a crossroads of, well, how do we want to change the government? Do we want to change the government by a popular uprising in which the ethnic groups basically each one grabs for his own piece of Iraq and tears it apart and the central government falls? Or was it an attempt just to use all of this domestic pressure, the pressure of uprising, to convince the traditional elite, which is a Sunni Muslim minority elite in Baghdad that has always represented the core of power in the country, is to convince that elite class, that ruling class, for it to do something about Saddam Hussein and to convince him to leave, to force him to leave. Instead, I think what you see is somewhat of a backlash here, in which the leadership class sees such a threat to the cohesiveness, the integrity of the country from a general uprising, that group has hung together fairly strongly in the last few weeks in order to first preserve Iraq before even thinking about what kind of government they might want in the future.
Why would the Bush administration see it as being in its best interest to have somebody else from the Sunni ruling class in power as opposed to a more democratic system?
I think it's an assessment that principally comes out of the U.S. intelligence community that Iraq can only be governed in one way, by a fairly harsh, fairly well-controlled, well-organized central government that's based in the Sunni Muslim minority. This is a tradition that has existed in the Middle East since these nations were carved up out of the mandates at the end of World War I. It is a recognition that if you the region is not ready for democracy, that if you left it to democratic forces, there would be anarchy, chaos, and separatism in countries like Iraq, which have strong ethnic groups and religious-based minorities in a diverse geographical mix that never saw themselves or acted as nation until artificial boundaries were effectively drawn around them and a strong central government with all the apparatus of control was created.
You know, the Kurds are saying that they think they were betrayed, that they were egged on, and then the United States withdrew any support. And from what you're saying, it sounds like they might be justified in feeling betrayed in the sense that there was some amount of support for the rebellion, but the United States didn't want to see the rebellion succeed. It wanted to see a military coup within the country. So there would never be supported enough to actually succeed, and that small amount of support put them in a very dangerous situation.
Well, you've got to keep this in perspective, I think. You have to, and also remember an important little piece of history. George Bush was CIA director when the Nixon and Ford administrations very cynically got involved with supporting the Kurds covertly to help the Shah of Iran put pressure on Saddam Hussein in the mid-1970s over a very bloody border dispute campaign between Iraq and Iran. And the moment that the Shah, that pressure campaign achieved its objective and convinced Saddam Hussein to sign a new border agreement with Iran, with the Shah of Iran, the CIA dumped the Kurds, and of course Baghdad began a brutal campaign of repression. George Bush did not invent that program, but he was CIA director during the course of the support for the Kurds and at the time of the signing of the treaty, the abandonment of the Kurds and the brutal campaign of repression that was launched at that moment by Baghdad to crush that rebellion. Today, we have a situation in which a coalition took action against Iraq with the authority of the United Nations Security Council to eject Iraqi occupation forces from Kuwait. That victory was so complete and so devastating on the Iraqi army that spontaneously insurrections erupted inside Iraq, not just Kurdish insurrection, but Shia insurrection in southern Iraq. But in any event, this was a spontaneous uprising that was not planned, and initially I don't believe, any discussion at high levels in the Bush administration whether to support it or whether not to support it. When it happened, I think they took some steps to nurture it, to protect it, banning any use by Baghdad of chemical weapons, banning any use of fixed-wing aircraft. So Your statement of the question, Terry, implies a deliberacy that I don't think was there. And I think the president and the Bush administration at this point is trying to find some middle course out of this in which it's going to take some heavy criticism, no matter which direction it turns, to satisfy some obligation to protect the Kurds, to protect the Shia, but at the same time stay within the mandate of the United Nations and get on with the reconstruction in the area after this war.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Patrick Tyler, a reporter for The New York Times, who has been reporting on the war and the war's aftermath. What about humanitarian aid? Is there a debate now in Washington about what the United States can be doing on a humanitarian level to help the people who are huddled at the borders, at the border of Turkey and unable to get in?
I think the Turks will open that border, Terry. Turkey, don't forget, was an important member of the coalition that undertook this campaign against Iraq. Turkey has its own history with the Kurds. It's not a very pretty one. Turkey had a very bad experience at the end of the Iran-Iraq war when the 100,000 refugees fled across the border, and Turkey ended up holding the bag, as it were, caring and feeding for these 100,000 Kurds who were afraid to go home and without much international assistance. So I think Turkey's initial statement that it would keep the border sealed was probably tactical to make sure that there was an international effort mobilizing to give Turkey some assistance to help these refugees and in bringing them across the border to get some money to pay for the food and the temporary housing, the tents, that they would need to stay there until they could come to terms with whether it was safe to go back to their homes in Iraq.
Earlier this week, you quoted an Iraqi expert named Christine Moss, and she said to you, what we have now in the Middle East is worse than what we had when Iraq was in Kuwait. We still don't have Saddam Hussein out of power, and now we have this deteriorating situation on the frontier between the Persians, the Arabs, and the Turks. Do you agree with what she told you?
I think it's too early to say that that judgment is correct, Terry. I think it's a very interesting point. Christine Moss Helms has been an Iraq scholar for a long time, and she's very smart and very well published on Iraqi affairs and in Islamic and Arab affairs. And I think her view is that basically we may have an extended low-intensity war inside Iraq for a long time, that the army has been so devastated by the Western alliance, the military alliance, that it won't be able to control the whole country all of the time, that it will be able to control the major cities, the key oil-producing facilities, but that there will be banditry and guerrilla warfare in the Iraqi countryside for the indefinite future, and that regional players who have interests in this instability, such as Iran, such as Syria, and maybe even Israel, will play their own cat's paw game in fueling the instability inside Iraq in a way that is not good for everyone's long-term interests in the region.
It wasn't too long ago, it was just a few weeks ago, that the mood seemed pretty jubilant in Washington and the Bush administration because we had won such a quick military win. What is the mood of the administration like now? Can you give us a sense of that from your sources?
Well, I think they're a little bit hunkered down. I think you see the president coming out almost on a daily basis and expressing his frustration and his anger and his disappointment at the carnage that is still going on inside Iraq, and a frustration over feeling with their hearts that they'd like to do something to help with the Kurds, but being told by their heads and by their allies that to do so might just further the instability and lead to the Lebanization or the fracturing of Iraq. Some people disagree with this, but what it all amounts to, when you put it all together, all of this disappointment, all of this frustration and this policy ambivalence for this, what actually was a very short period of time, is that you already see the charges of moral failure, and that somehow this clean victory that the Allies had won on the battlefield against the Iraqi army has become a soiled and somewhat degraded event in the course of Middle Eastern affairs.
Well, Patrick Tyler, I thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm happy to do it. Thank you.
Patrick Tyler of the New York Times. Coming up, a different point of view on America's policy on the Iraqi uprising. We talk with Professor Fred Halliday. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. Fred Halliday says the U.S. could have done more to protect Iraqis from Saddam Hussein's brutal suppression of their rebellion. We called Fred Halliday in London. He's a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics, and he's written extensively on the Middle East for The Nation and the Middle East Report. Many Iraqis say President Bush betrayed them by calling for an uprising, then standing by as the rebels were slaughtered. I asked Halliday what he thinks.
Well, there's two aspects to the question. I think one is many people find it difficult to think that the United States has any business becoming involved in supporting opposition movements in Iraq or anywhere else, since they regard U.S. intervention as always pernicious and always self-seeking. They don't want to see it. Now, the policies of the United States are always self-seeking, like those of any other state. But there are cases in which intervention on the side of democratic forces could and would be justified. The United States, very late in the day, swung behind the independence of Namibia, and I'm not against the independence of Namibia, just because the United States' reasons for doing that might have been self-seeking. Moreover, there are classic cases in the post-war period of what one could call humanitarian intervention. I mean, the Indian invasion of East Pakistan in 1971 in support of the independence of Bangladesh was a clear case of that, even though India's motives were obviously self-seeking. So I think that you've got to get to that. The heart of the matter is, can people who, for very good reasons, are against 95% of all forms of U.S. intervention, except there might be 5% where this intervention was justified? I happen to think it is. The second thing is, did they make commitments to the Kurds? Yes. Bush's statement in mid-February, appealing to the Iraqi people to rise up, was a green light to people to do something. Moreover, the United States' clear preference for removal of Saddam Hussein was a green light. It was a form of encouragement. You cannot fire off a missile and then say you're not responsible for where it lands. And this is, in effect, is what they've done. So I think they should have done something, and there are a number of things they could have done short of sending troops into Iraq.
Such as?
They could have simply said that if Saddam Hussein moved artillery, moved tanks, moved helicopters, moved significant numbers of troops into Kurdistan a week or 10 days ago, then the United States would bomb those forces. In other words, they would have issued a threat to Saddam, which in the light of what had just happened in Kuwait, he would have taken very seriously indeed, which would simply have, in effect, frozen the situation and allowed the Kurds to consolidate the situation. At the same time, you could have provided substantial assistance to the Kurds in form of food, because the Iraqis would have blockaded the area, in the form of medical supplies, in the form of diplomatic encouragement, and frankly, in terms of arms. So without actually General Schwarzkopf marching on Baghdad, you could have arrested, stopped Saddam's counterattack against the Kurds, and secondly, allowed the Kurds to build up their strength. And let's be clear about it, the Kurds are acting in liaison with other democratic forces inside Iraq. So there's a lot that could have been done short of actually simply occupying the whole of Iraq. Now, people say, well, this is against the UN Charter. I agree that it's not something that can be done under the terms of the UN Charter, but it's something which is perfectly justified in terms of broader arguments of humanitarian intervention.
Do you think that the Allies want to see a military coup in Iraq, but not a popular uprising?
The United States has been calling for a military coup for some time. The CIA-backed opposition radio station, Voice of Free Iraq, has been appealing to the Iraqi army to rise up. This is not the hidden agenda, but the not 100% formal agenda. It was hoped it would happen before the war began on the 15th of January, then it would happen before the start of the ground war. It didn't happen, but this is still what they're hoping. And this is the goal of the longer-term strategy they're now pursuing, which is to deny Iraq the wherewithal to rebuild its armed forces. The military sanctions and the industrial production-related sanctions to stop Iraq from rebuilding its forces, and all these other things about getting rid of chemical and nuclear weapons and so forth, and artillery and all the rest of it, all of that is part of an attempt to put pressure on the Iraqi army, saying you can only rebuild yourselves if you get rid of Saddam and those around him. So that is a clear goal, there's no doubt about it, and they would prefer to see some kind of pro-Western military coup or military regime of the kind they've had in Pakistan for years, they've had on and off in Turkey, to seeing a non-military regime emerge.
George Bush has said that the United States, you know, has no role interfering in another country's civil war. Yet Bush used to be the head of the CIA, and everybody knows that the CIA has intervened in civil wars of other countries in the past. So do you find that kind of statement basically hypocritical because of America's past history?
Well, it's nonsense in the sense that any form of influence of another country's politics, domestic or international, is a form of interference. And the question is not do you or do you not interfere, but to what purpose, on the basis of what criteria? And the first criterion is very simple. Is what you're doing one that commands support within the country or not? If you attack a country where the government is a democratic one and has overwhelming popular support, then clearly what you're doing is wrong. If, on the other hand, you assist the people in that country who want to get rid of their oppressive government and encourage them by diplomatic, economic, humanitarian aid, and for that matter financial means to do so, then that is construed in terms of the key criterion something that one can support. After all, nobody objects to financial aid or military aid being sent to the guerrillas in South Africa who are opposed to the South African government, unless you are a complete pacifist, which is another point, but most people aren't arguing in those terms. And I think that the issue is therefore not do you or do not intervene, but do you or do you not intervene on the right side. Now, you can get into a long argument about what the right side is, but that is the core of the issue. You had the same thing in Central America. Everybody said, oh, the Americans are intervening against the Sandinistas. No one should intervene. And then the Sandinistas would say, look, we're against American intervention, but we support our struggling brothers and sisters in El Salvador. The key issue is, on whose side are you? Are you on the side of the people who are trying to get a legitimate government overthrown, which is what the United States is trying to do in Nicaragua, or are you trying to overthrow a tyrannical government, which is what was happening in the case of El Salvador? And I think that is the key issue. And if you pin it only on the question of non-intervention, you're living in cloud cuckoo land.
Do you think that the Allies had any idea that the kind of uprising and the kind of slaughter that we're seeing now, the huge number of refugees, would take place as a result of the war?
I don't think that Bush or anyone else in the West looked at the political consequences of a war while the war was going on, let alone before it began. They hoped that some miraculous solution would come about through either killing Saddam Hussein with a cruise missile hitting him or by a coup. I mean, those were the two hopes, but it didn't happen that way. Beyond that, they just didn't know. And what they thought was, well, we'll get on with the fighting. We won't think about what's going to happen afterwards. They didn't think. And in particular, they were not prepared for the uprising and what would have been involved in not just the military support of it, which is pretty straightforward, but the diplomatic support of it. I think another particular blind spot was a failure to see the great interest and potential role of Iran, so that when Iran did come to play a role, when the Iraqi planes went there and when the Iranians started to support the uprising in the south, this created panic for a while in Saudi Arabia and in the West, and people said we must have anything to do with this opposition because the Iranians are backing it. The fact is, the Iran that is backing the opposition is not the Iran of Ayatollah Khomeini, and this Iran wants to play a role in the future political system in the Middle East. It has a legitimate voice to be heard on regional matters and also on Iraqi matters, where a lot of people look to Iran with some sympathy.
Fred Halliday is a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. He spoke to us from London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.